Yesterday, on my way to this meeting place, I stopped at the traffic light and fell suddenly into a burning ring of fire and began to imagine that our purpose here was not merely to discuss the probable future of white people in Western societies, but rather to take real action in an attempt to salvage at least some residue of the Caucasian demographic, Caucasian habits, and the Western high culture. For although we don't judge Caucasians by their present-day behavior, we do know that in the past, unlike most other races, white people have sometimes created admirable societies and might do so again. We thought of those cosmologists who search for exoplanets that might be made habitable after our own planet has ceased to exist. Likewise, in the same vein, we begin to discuss places on Earth might offer sanctuary for Caucasians who wish to give Western civilization, even if just in miniature scale, another century or two of continued existence. With that in mind, we voted to send one of our members to sniff out the possibilities in Canada, a large territory to the immediate north of our own country, where a fair number of awakened people have already drawn off into the corners of that politically correct domain and have begun to resist the summons of ethnic suicide. That emissary of ours, who happens to be with us here today, remained 4 months, and having at last recuperated from a really very serious case of frostbite, reported back that the Canadians had invested so thoroughly in the theory of universal human equality, that no realistic hope remained there for a recrudescence of our traditional culture. I imagined then that we had assigned yet another agent to the country of Argentina, a South American organization said to have been settled primarily by immigrants from Italy and Spain. A not unpleasant locale, topographically speaking, our representative nevertheless found there a debased and very heterogeneous population only slightly superior to that of Honduras or Haiti or invertebrate Mexico. At that point, we opted to ignore that country and indeed the entire hemisphere thereto attached. We tried Australia, but not for very long. From having once enjoyed the best immigration policy in the world, that island has recently discovered a need for ever larger numbers of hard-working, unsmiling Chinese. With the white fertility ratio now in negative territory, the Australians are looking even further afield for new citizens, including especially in such locales as American Indian reservations, Lapland, Detroit, Kyrgyzstan, and the Central African Republic. On the bright side, they have abrogated some of the rules and regulations directed against English speakers. In the wake of these disappointments, we met again 18 months later in an inconspicuous town, a place rarely visited by the national media. It is true that a bitter debate then broke out on the second day and that our former fellowship was damaged by a much too vehement debate in which 4 of the members spoke for remaining in America and continuing the struggle here at home for the resumption of racial inequality. The notion was voted down, however, whereupon one of the attendees got suddenly to his feet, made a hissing noise, departed, and never came back again. It wasn't until the 3rd week of our conference that the delegate from Lincolnshire in England, a certain Derek Turner, mentioned the name of a place called New Zealand as a possibility. His suggestion was at first received silence. Known mostly for America's remoteness from that place and its strange fauna, we needed time to absorb the suggestion. Comprised mostly of 2 large islands, with a gap between them. The country was known to have been settled in 1840 by British people who, without great effort, were able to impose themselves on the Aboriginal people who quickly learned to get the hell out of the way. Dismayed by the quality of the natives, the fair-minded British nevertheless refrained from what they could so easily have done, even allowing these people to marry and own property and to sustain themselves as a certain percentage of the population. Despite that, the culture of those islands was said to be distinctly European, more European indeed than most parts of modern Europe itself. As for the topography, the lakes and rivers, woods and fields, the mountains and their requisite valleys, these features have come together just about perfectly in this most inviting of all locations. Especially the South Island is regarded by connoisseurs as among the most gorgeous acreages in the whole wide world. Our delegate needed very little time to verify this description and then come running back to us with his eyes all aglow. And so, as I continued dreaming, I imagined that by October, five of us, together with our families, had made the long journey to New Zealand's South Island, where we wasted the first several days accustoming ourselves to the southern sky with its odd-looking constellations. But this was nothing as compared to the upside-down seasons, which became more and more abnormal the further south we traveled. It was late September by this time, a propitious season, more or less equal in quality to early April in more northerly parts. Never will I forget it, the supernal views that offered themselves as we squeezed our way through the channel that divides the two main islands. I thought I saw a flight of kiwi birds overhead, which is to say, until I was informed that these creatures had long ago lost the penchant for flying. We wasted two further weeks behaving like tourists, but by October, we had found homes for ourselves, picturesque villages in the island's southeasternmost quadrant. The views were excellent, and the water not as frigid as has all too unthinkingly been imputed to the Pacific Ocean. The schools were good, too, most of them, and the citizenry spoke a better grade of English than did we interlopers. The price of real estate wasn't greatly unlike what prevailed in the United States, and for the most part, the national diet was not altogether unacceptable. As you can see, we were already thinking of applying for citizenship, and except for the presence of some 22,000 Maori Aborigines, we'd probably have done so before the first 2 months were out. You must remember, too, that we were retired people with sufficient income, or, in the case of the Abercrombie family, wealthy enough to offer non-assumable 5- and 10-year loans at a rate only slightly more than twice that of prevailing treasury notes. Opportunities, of course, for employment were limited, it is true, and yet we had no hesitation in summoning our friends and relatives to come and join us. At this point, I will admit that it needed some courage to denounce our American citizenship and to become authentic New Zealanders with all the responsibilities and benefits thereunto attached. We had to adjust to a new social code that allowed us to speak to neighbors or even strangers without being chided for our genetic identity. Slowly and slowly, we became aware that our island was not dropping bombs on any other country, no matter how weak and small. I can honestly testify that I have seen 12- and 13-year-old boys and girls enjoying each other's company, even in the absence of full penetration. Friends and relatives, they came slowly at first, reluctant to leave behind a country that had produced the antebellum South and had once given promise of developing into something like ancient Greece or Florence or London in Elizabeth's day. Instead of that, the U.S. had merely gotten rich and powerful and more detestable with each succeeding election. Particularly, it was the election of 2024 that drove more than 400 American Caucasian families to our little island and made possible the election of some of our own people to local offices. Truth is, we had already become an identifiable demographic, despised by some, applauded by others. Evidence of hostility had quickly broken out in the township of Riverton, a widely reported event that revealed what sort of people were these American newcomers, who not only spoke with an accent, but also had refused to surrender their guns at the border. Month by month, the island's young people came to us, demanding to be given a role in the rioting and the electioneering that followed in our wake. We were bolstered by the people of Invercargill, the largest town of some 50,000 souls, the first to rally to our cause. Came next Dunedin, where the town council agreed to hear us out. By this time, we numbered better than 2,000, and had won the support, or anyway the tolerance, of an appreciable minority of the island's voters. Polls showed that no less than 31% of the people were glad for our presence on the island, or at least were not overtly hostile to our project of prolonging Western civilization for another century or two. We were a Faustian race, we tried to explain, who had come to fulfill and then to supersede itself. Thus we recommended ourselves, boasting that we were of the same race as had given more to life than all the others added up together. Our own country, we explained, had surrendered to the imperial temptation and had by now become so heterogeneous that a coherent culture was no longer feasible. Life in America, we went on, now required a degree of cultural toleration indistinguishable from nihilism. But what we mostly understood was that the notion of across-the-board, universal, wall-to-wall, categorical human equality was, as Alex Krutajic has shown, the most immoral and most suicidal concept ever to find acceptance in an educated, or anyway, a semi-educated nation. He saw, did Alex, that equality and quality hate each other, and that an equal society is perforce a lowest common denominator society that will always be finding new ways to slough off standards and to marginalize its own best people. And finally, we understood that an equal society will soon become unequal again, except that this time it will be the worst who are considered the best and the best the worst. We understood, too, that in postmodern times, television has the authority to nudge people in any direction the producers want, while at the same time undermining the most instinctual and time-honored tradition. We understood, too, that we had in our midst a man so very rich that he could take control, if he so wished, of the island's most important television network. By this time, our numbers had increased to just more than 8,500. Good persons, most of them, venturesome enough to bring their savings, their relatives, and their experience in starting businesses and commercial operations. Some were merely opportunists, of course, ordinary folk, fleeing conditions in the U.S. and in Europe, where the demographics were turning more and more decidedly against white people and their standards. Which is not to say that those standards weren't also in a state of advanced decay. Indeed, it had become difficult to say whether it were the Democrats who were diminishing the United States or the United States that was degrading the immigrants. Because decadence, feeding on the applause of the masses, had become irreversible by now. Timaru, a maritime city that overlooks the sea, was the first place in New Zealand to fall under our sway. Having elected a majority of the town council, we summoned together the some 158 Maori Aborigines who lived in the vicinity and offered each man and woman of them a full 1,500 New Zealand dollars to emigrate and not come back again. Those willing to undergo sterilization were offered twice that amount, a promise that very nearly bankrupted the city treasury. It is hard to describe the anger directed at us by the island's good-thinking people, not to mention the reaction in the international press. The United Nations had involved itself, and we were summoned to appear before the International Court. On the other hand, the town's expatriate population, American, more than doubled in the following 7 months, with people from nearby towns beginning to cluster around the three villages we now controlled. We were in some danger of comprising a city until the authorities, just in the nick of time, made that impossible. The rest of the story is well known to you. How by 2028, we had managed to gain an electoral majority over the entire island and could begin at last to put into effect the policies that had inspired us from the start. Determined to evade the banality of democracy, we wanted a system in which a majority of fools and mediocrities could not overrule a minority of more admirable people. We wanted to put in place a governing elite composed of people who were able to think, recognizing, as we did, that the mass of human beings are capable only of taking into account one or two prevailing orthodoxies and then choosing the one that promises to be the least demanding. We wanted to build a community prepared to give the smallest possible attention to material concerns and the remaining part to matters of importance, the precise reverse of all established practice up until that point. In short, we wanted to break through the glass ceiling of human nature and begin the process of obsolescing ourselves. We wanted to organize our own evolution and become a new species. Of course, it was dangerous. There was China and the United States to contend with, the United Nations, NATO, the EU, bilateral trade agreements, the Kansas City Flower Club. All these organizations, institutions, would want to put us out of business as promptly as possible and sink our little island beneath the waves. And who could blame them? If our experiment were successful, it would prove the whole world had been hideously mistaken over the most recent 5,000 years. In the event, it happened that we had a certain famous toxicologist in our town, a man as devoted to our adventure as anyone well could be. He it was who gave us the safety we desired. Too small and too poor to develop nuclear weapons, far less than needed delivery systems, our man cooked up, so to speak, 2 tons of a certain highly contagious virus that must not be named here by actual name. Thereafter, it was an easy matter for our agents to stow vacuum-sealed containers of this material in the major cities of the several countries that might pose a threat. For our further defense, we listened to the island's foremost classical scholar, who described for us how some of the veterans of Alexander had formed themselves into an army called the Silver Shields, a force of septuagenarians who were to prove the most terrifying fighting force of the age. Widowers, most of them, whose children had grown up and become independent, these were people who had no further responsibilities and had become largely indifferent as to their own survival. We had hoped for volunteers and were nonplussed that in the first week alone, some 1,626 such persons came forward, 70 and 75, and yes, even some 80-year-olds, who within 6 weeks could bench press their own weight and run 5 miles in less than 45 minutes. Posted at intervals along our shore, they defended us most adequately from tourists, immigrants, refugees, and photojournalist from the New York Times. Even better, they defeated all attempts by the North Island, now merely 88% white, to force us to reunite. And finally, as if that were not enough, a team of physicists from our national university had developed a so-called quantum escribulator capable of dissolving molecular bonds over long distances. I should add that in 2023, there really was an attempt on our island by a force of North Islanders prepped and supplied by the U.S. Department of Education in collaboration with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. This attempted invasion failed utterly, owing to the courage and skill of some few dozen elderly hoplites, we call them, four of whom sacrificed themselves in the effort. Since that time, no other effort has been made against our fortress home. In all this time, the committee had been steadily at work on our new constitution, or, as we call it, our confession of sovereign laws. We had wanted an organic document that would militate unambiguously against consumerism as a lifestyle, against feminism, against globalism and universal rights, but for a high culture making constant war against the ever-present aggressions of the low culture that militates constantly for tolerance, which is to say, tawdriness in all walks of life. Most of all, we were adamant against immigration and the racial deterioration consequent thereunto. We wanted a society that preferred quality to equality. Indeed, we sought a final termination of the very name and notion of equality, believing as we did that not even subatomic particles could be found to be equal in all respects, far less automobiles or horses or restaurants or cultures or works of music and literature. Equality, we hold, is simply a capitulation to mediocrity, and finally, sub-mediocrity, all the way down to the current practice of the decaying USA. We wanted our philosophy to suffuse the island under the leadership of our best, or anyway, our least benighted citizens. In pursuance of that, we needed penalties that were neither too severe nor yet too lax. In short, we wanted penalties that were just wrong. For minor crimes such as littering, loud music, the mistreatment of dogs, loose trousers, and pigtails, we assigned a period of hard labor in reforestation projects, highway cleanup, and the like. For crimes of the middling sort, permanent expulsion was the punishment, and the only one. But for the most egregious forms of behavior, treason, rape, book theft, and child molestation, the punishment cannot be described where sensitive people may be present. Safe to report that it is related to one of the creatures held for that purpose in the National Aquarium. We called our organization the Node, named after a certain piece of classical American fiction. Our group was very, very hard to enter, and very, very easy was it to be expelled from it. With an income no higher than the island's average, the committee members eliminated greed from any possible motive of theirs. Nepotism is strictly disallowed, and since decisions were not attributed to individuals, we hoped also to remove the desire for prestige from our members' motives. We wanted, in short, to behave like experimental philosophers questing for a form of civilization that might prove significantly less awful than any that had gone before. But it is with our national budget that we have most clearly given expression to our intentions. With the population of white people, welfare benefits were seldom needed. And because we had no role in international connections, we had only to pay for a certain tonnage of viral material, together with shotgun shells for our army of old men. Taken all together, our defense budget consumed just 3.2% of revenue, a tiny sum compared to the 12.8% dedicated to the National Library, 12.9% for one major and three regional Wagnerian opera houses, 7.4% for six publishing firms that were freed by this allocation from having to show a profit, 9.6% for a new radio telescope to be set up on Mount Tasman, and 5.1% for the new National Gallery of Unpretentious Art. Except for another 15.5% for other basic and required expenses, we were left with 7.4% for the education of generic people and 29.1% for the gifted, which is to say approximately 2% of the island's population. More than any other country, we specialized in the development of spirituality, intellectual excellence, and the promotion of genius. 5 years of this, and the island led international rankings of educational success on a per capita basis. And though we had but 4 universities, they easily supplied us with the sort of men who, in course of time, will be invited to join the committee. So this is it, ladies and gentlemen. This is what passed through my mind as I waited for the traffic light to change from red to green. Well, it's an elitist society that I would love to see set up, where brains count for more than money-making ability.
But how is money made?
How is money made?
I mean,
on this island?
Yeah.
Well, we're on the sea, you see, and we can provide seafood and sea sports, and we can take in each other's laundry. We can do the things that any...
So no large-scale manufacturing?
Absolutely not.
Really?
We don't want that. In fact, we live in an austere form of life, you know. We don't want the products of industry. You know, we live the way people lived in this country before the Civil War. You know, it's an agricultural society.
Yeah, you said something about, like, for society to not promote more material success.
Yeah. We militate against consumerism, against possession as a form of prestige. I mean, you know, if you look back at classical Greece, you can read 1,000 pages of classical Greek history, never read anything about the economy. You know, how the hell they make a living. You know, they did a little fishing, had a few sheep farms, but look how well they did intellectually.
What about medicine?
Well, you know, we have Hippocrates and a few others like that. Medicine, we have great universities on that island, can produce wonderful doctors. We do have universities. Could do the things that need to be done. But we don't have software manufacturers, and we don't have steel and iron manufacturers. It's a reactionary economy, the way people lived in the high Middle Ages.
So
I know. It's
done like agriculture.
Yeah,
agriculture. Like growing your own food, raising
yes,
your own animals.
Yeah, and for sale. Seafood, fishing.
So there's private property here?
Yes, private property. But the island's so small. You know, there's only got 1 million people on the island. And they're all Europeans except a small group of Maori Aborigines who are very primitive people. The British put up with them because they're British. And they're wards of the state. They're not quite as debased as the Aborigines of Australia, which are really almost, you know, Stone Age conditions. And some of them have become, some of them have become productive citizens. But the British government, being as tolerant as they are, has taken care of them and given them housing. I don't mean to demean the whole tribe, you know, but just that South Sudan would be so much better if it were a homogenous society, in my opinion.
Tito, who are some of the political philosophers who have influenced your thinking?
Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Nietzsche most of all. But Plato, of course. I think Plato invented metaphysics, really. So I greatly admire him. And in more modern times, Evola. And what's Evola's predecessor's name, the guy that inspired him?
Yeah.
Nietzsche has just turned my life around. He turned me upside down. Mm-hmm. I'd never read anything like that before. You know, it just, it takes ordinary living, you know. And you say I'm a contrary. Nietzsche is the real contrary. And his belief, you know, that humans can go as far as they can go. You know, that bourgeois morality is a hindrance to human beings. And that everyone could, no, not everyone, but that people become almost godlike if they were to fully apply their abilities. You know, that just turned me on. Love nature.
What are your thoughts about religion?
Well, oddly enough, I do believe in supernal values, transcendent values. But I've come to think that they're to be, you can access them not through religion, but through physics. And if you read modern cosmology, and they speak of parallel universes, and they speak of a universe of billions of universes, multi-universes, my goodness, I mean, the opportunity, what might not be out there, you know? What might not be possible in a universe like that? I mean, it may be that we're in the very primitive stages of civilization. And someday we'll be able to travel such places. We'll be able to travel here. And that, I find my supernal beliefs come through, mostly through art. You know, when I'm listening to certain operas or something. Really, you know, Schopenhauer, I think, said that art is a hole in reality, a vacuum. A vacuo, you know, where the fabric of will is momentarily suspended, and you can be free of will. The torment of will give you a vacation for a little while you're listening to a great piece of music. He himself loved the art, Schopenhauer. And art, not religion, art. That's my religion. Yeah. Well, it won't take place any time in the near future. You know, but if current trends continue, I mean, if white people really do become a minority, and then maybe a severe minority, I think there'll be an exodus.
You don't like having my stuff?
My stuff?
You don't want a piece of land, own a house, own a car?
I have all those. I have 2 houses.
Yeah. And it's good stuff.
Really?
Besides, so we get nice stuff.
What?
We get nice stuff from Walmart.
No,
we get nice
stuff. Well, I didn't get my TV there, but
I think he sort of has a kind of hobbit-like fantasy, complete with New Zealand settings.
Nice.
And hobbits have nice stuff. It's just made to last.
So he's probably
I think this is a good time to stop. So, Tito, thank you very much for this.